This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to our series on inequality, The Lines Between Us. About 40% of African-American students in Maryland's public four-year colleges attend one of the state's four historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs: Morgan State University, Coppin State, Bowie State, and the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. HBCUs say they are suffering the consequences of underfunding during segregation and for decades after it. In 2006, a group of HBCU students and alums called the Coalition for Equity and Excellence in Higher Education sued the Maryland Higher Education Commission in federal court, arguing it would take $2 billion to make up for past underfunding. The case has not yet been decided. Today, we ask, what does Maryland owe its HBCUs? And why does Maryland still need HBCUs if most African-American students attend traditionally white schools? We talk with a former student at an HBCU, as well as Delegate Aisha Braveboy of Prince George's County, who chairs the Legislative Black Caucus of Maryland. But first, we talk with Professor Ray Winbush, Director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University. Winbush went to Oakwood University, a tiny HBCU in Alabama. I asked him how that experience shaped who he is today.
Oh, it shaped me completely. I graduated out of high school in Cleveland, Ohio. I think I was number 455th in a class of 600. I had applied to several
You
colleges.
Were not a good student.
No, by no means. I barely got out of high school. My mom didn't finish high school. My dad was a steel worker. But my dad said, you're going to college. And he really had no real conception. He just knew that college would do something for me. So I applied to Oakwood, got accepted. And for some reason, because I saw my money being paid through the window, tuition, which was the enormous sum at that time of $240 a year, I started making good grades. At the end of my sophomore year, I won a scholarship to Harvard. End of my junior year, I won a scholarship to Yale. And I just tightened up. It literally changed my life.
What was it about that HBCU?
I think it was
turned you around.
It was the first time, even though I was raised in an inner city situation in Cleveland, it was the first time I saw black intellectuals who were teaching me. One of my professors was the late O.B. Edwards, who was a student of George Washington Carver. And then you saw other students who were very bright. And so there was all of these ambitions among the students, motivation on the part of the faculty for you to just be your best. And that was absent in the K through 12 system I had emerged from in inner city Cleveland. Very different.
That's Professor Ray Winbush, Director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University. Here on WIPR Maryland Morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the value of historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs. How important is it that historically black colleges and universities remain majority black?
I think it's interesting that when we talk about institutions of higher education, we have all women's institutions like Mount Holyoke, Bryn Mawr, Sarah Lawrence. We have Jewish institutions such as Brandeis, Yeshiva. We have Catholic institutions like Notre Dame. But it's for some reason those schools are never asked, should we still have Catholic schools? Should we still have all women's schools? Should we still have all Jewish institutions? I think that the answer to your question directly is, of course we should keep HBCUs. But I think the reason why that question is asked has a lot to do with them being a reminder of the unfinished business dealing with racism in our society.
Explain that.
I think black colleges remind this country about how these institutions were born out of segregation and racism. And despite underfunding, despite separation, and in many cases, despite violence, these institutions prospered. They're reminders of a time that this nation wants to forget. The legacy of enslavement and segregation. Whereas the other institutions that only teach women, primarily teach Jews, you know, cater predominantly to Catholics, those are okay institutions. It's all right for women to still be educated at all women's schools or Catholics primarily. But for some reason, we look at Black institutions as being, you know, we don't want to talk about they keep reminding us of a past that America doesn't want to deal with.
There are a couple of differences, one being there certainly are private HBCUs, but sure. Many of them are state schools. So
yes.
Different questions are raised when you're talking about taxpayer funding. I'd also say there are a lot of women's colleges that looked at the question and said,
right.
No, it's better for our students actually to study with men. I mean, we have a lot fewer women's colleges around, including in Maryland. Maryland has just one women's college left. So
yeah.
I think that question has been asked. And, yeah. and it leads me to what I want to ask you about diversity. I mean, is diversity an issue at HBCUs?
No. The most diverse faculty in the state of Maryland is Morgan State University. It's interesting that when we talk about faculty diversity, HBCUs have always had a diverse faculty. I used to teach at Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee, before coming to Morgan. And it was the most diverse private faculty of any school in the state of Tennessee. And when we talk about student bodies, the burden of, quote, diversity is usually placed upon HBCUs, even though we see institutions in the state of Maryland that are predominantly white, you know, student body-wise. But we don't say, well, they need to be more diverse. Or we do say it, but we don't. It's, again, the burden said we've got to integrate more the Black institutions. We've got to get more white students going to the Black institutions. And I think that that's an unnecessary burden being placed on historically Black colleges.
Well, I'm asking it to try to understand whether you or how you feel you are preparing students mm-hmm. who are going to function in an economy mm-hmm. where most of the people they're going to work with and most of the people they're going to compete against mm-hmm. are not Black.
Right.
Are they getting the experience at an HBCU that prepares them for that?
I think they get it even more because it's like if I'm at a predominantly white institution and I'm a Black student, first of all, I'm going to be more isolated. I taught at Vanderbilt University for a number of years in Nashville, predominantly white institution, the so-called Harvard of the South. And Black students would flock to me and a handful of other Black faculty there to just get support. They were really prepared for the white world in the sense that they felt that they oftentimes, not all of them, but many of them felt, can I really compete? Black colleges, you know, or as far as I'm concerned, they prepare you because you see leadership. You see, you just feel better. And I know this sounds abstract, but you feel better about who you are as an individual. You see Black graduates at commencement who go on to get PhDs and are always talking about graduate school. You don't see that at predominantly white institutions, not as much. So I think that the preparation is that many students are, Black students come through, as I said earlier, educational abuse from K through 12. They need a respite from that so that they can recharge their engine, or in some cases just simply charge their engine so that they can compete at a level that, you know, that they haven't been used to even seeing or experiencing when they were in K through 12.
So let me ask you then about one of the measures, and I know this is just one measure
sure.
by which the success of a college is measured, and that is how many of the students who start end up actually getting a
right.
degree within 6 years.
Yes.
None of the four HBCUs in
right.
Maryland have a graduation rate higher than 50%.
Right.
Most of the traditionally white institutions have
sure.
much higher graduation rates. Coppin State's graduation rate is less than 20%.
Again, I think we negate the history of the students that HBCUs take. We take Raymond Winbushes, who people would look at a transcript from high school and say, uh-uh.
What are you thinking, taking this
you
guy?
You must be insane, but can produce a Ray Winbush. I think what it is that it's almost like, well, you're not graduating people as much as the University of Maryland, for example, or in a private, you know, setting, Johns Hopkins. But it's, we've got to look at who comes into our schools and what we do to provide them with educational rehabilitation. But it's almost as if these students all came there at their freshman year experiencing the same type of educational system that their white counterparts experience, and they don't. It's like we don't want to talk about what happened to them prior to coming to the institution and what we did for them while they were there. We don't want to talk about that.
Professor Ray Winbush, Director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University. This is The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning, WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Today we're talking about the value of HBCUs. For another view, we're joined by Antonio Johnson. He began college at an HBCU, Morgan State, but didn't graduate from there. That's because he transferred to Towson University last year to avoid waiting several years for two required courses to be taught. We asked what other factors he considered in his decision to leave Morgan.
The professors there treat you like your family. That's what I like. That's what I love the most about Morgan State.
But it's different at Towson?
Yes, it's different at Towson. Towson, the workload is challenging, but I understood what I was sacrificing when I went to Towson because I knew in the long run I would be able to get a better job if I went to a school that challenged me the most.
In what ways are you being challenged at Towson that you didn't feel you were being challenged at Morgan State?
I'm taking a public relations writing course mm-hmm. at Towson, and my professors I've turned in papers to my professors, and they've marked it up, and I have to go back and improve on those mistakes that I made. So they hold me accountable for certain things that I wouldn't have been held accountable for if I were at Morgan.
We spoke with Professor Ray Winbush, director of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State, and he told us that black students are more isolated at traditionally white institutions. Has that been your experience at Towson?
I would have to really disagree with Dr. Winbush, because I feel as though at traditionally white colleges, you get a dose of reality. You get acclimated and you get comfortable with what's going to happen when you come out of college. Because the professional world in America is not just black. It's black, white, Hispanic, Asian Americans. And just all those cultures, Caribbean Americans and people from all around the world. You're going to be stepping into that professional world when you get out of there. Ever since I left Morgan, I've had amazing opportunities at Towson. I've made friends my first year. And you get this sense of unity amongst different student groups on campus. Like we have the Latino American student organization, we have Caribbean Student Association, Muslim Student Association, and the African Diaspora Association, and the Black Student Union. You have all these groups, and they say, well, you know, come stop in our office anytime you want to, you know, come talk to us, come meet with us. If you want to come join our group, you come join our group. And, oh, hey, welcome to Towson.
Okay, I have to ask you, because as you know, Towson's getting a lot of attention these days for
yes.
another group, the White Student Union that
yes.
some students have formed, not a part of the university, but the Southern Poverty Law Center has labeled it a hate group.
Yes.
Does the fact that that's also on campus make you uncomfortable about your decision to switch?
It doesn't make me uncomfortable. Him starting that group, it doesn't cancel out the fact that Towson is a diverse school. People have came together and said, we're not going to tolerate this at Towson. We're not going to have this. And they don't want it at Towson. And I've seen it. I've seen student groups across Towson unite together and say, well, we don't want this group on campus.
Antonio Johnson, a student at Towson University, majoring in advertising. On WIPR, this is The Lines Between Us. I'm Sheila Cast. A top priority of the Legislative Black Caucus of Maryland this year was to get more money for the historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs, in the state budget. They ended up getting about $4 million, less than a third of what they sought. Delegate Aisha Braveboy of Prince George's County chairs the Black Caucus. She joined us by phone from Annapolis, and I asked why she was seeking the money.
What we looked at are two different things. We looked at some immediate short-term needs, and those short-term needs included additional faculty on the campus, full-time faculty, because many of the students, not only at the HBCUs, but many other universities across the state, really need the guidance of someone who's on campus, who has regular office hours, who can assist them with their coursework. That's something that many of the HBCUs don't have a lot of. They have a lot of adjunct professors, and adjunct professors are wonderful, but by their very nature, they're not on campus full-time. They have other jobs, other careers, other priorities. And so we wanted more professors who were dedicated solely to the development of the children on the campus. So converting adjunct faculty to full-time faculty was a major focus. The other focus was increased money for student financial aid. The reason why that became such an important issue this year, as it has always been, it's always been a major issue because children at the HBCUs disproportionately are relying on some type of financial assistance, whether it's Pell Grants or merit scholarships or other types of financial aid. One of the things that occurred this year, or last year actually, was a change in the Pell Grant formula at the federal level, which actually took a lot of young people off of eligibility for Pell Grants. And so that impacted the historically black colleges and universities because many of those students were no longer eligible and were no longer receiving financial aid at the federal level, which impacted the amount of money coming to the universities.
You did not get most of what you were asking for. What are you coming out of the session with?
Well, we were able to get some additional money in the supplemental budget, which came out last week. And the governor met with members of the caucus last, I believe it was Tuesday. We talked about what the needs were, the fact that they were not in the regular budget, but that we know that he has an opportunity to put more money in the supplemental budget for historically black colleges and universities for those two specific reasons. And so at the conclusion of the meeting, the governor did agree to include additional money for those purposes. But we're still pressing along because the short-term issues that we want to address is only part of the story. The larger story are the longer-term systemic problems and issues that the lawsuit brought by the Coalition for Excellence in Higher Education sought to address in their lawsuit. And that, and to resolve those issues and to really deal with the parity and equity issue, we're not talking about a few million here or there. We're talking about several hundred million. And so that's a longer-term issue that we have begun to address this year. We actually were also able to get language in the supplemental budget that would propose a long-term plan and solution for funding and bringing parity to the HBCUs. So we're starting the process over the interim, this interim, not to study the issue of whether or not there was underfunding. That's clear, that's well documented, but the issue for us now is how do we get to where we want to go?
Delegate Aisha Braveboy of Prince George's County, chair of the Legislative Black Caucus of Maryland. We reached out to the state's chief of litigation, Stephen Sullivan. He declined to be interviewed, but he supplied budget letters showing that in recent years, Maryland has budgeted more, especially for buildings and facilities, for the historically black institutions than the traditionally white ones. We've posted those letters on our website, as well as the coalition's legal arguments. That's linesbetweenus.org. The lawsuit has not yet been decided. That's The Lines Between Us for this week. You're listening to Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us on 88.1.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus. Or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at WYPR.org. Have a great day.